Hi there, this is Loria Chews of Four Leg Rehab Incorporated, your place for online canine rehab education. And in today's training audio, I wanted to talk or pass along my thoughts on return to sport and look a little bit into some research that's out there and how you can be applying it. So I wanted to start off with a story about my youngest son, Cole. So he plays football, and that would be North American football. And he, I can't remember what he did. Anyways, he injured his hip. And he would have pain in his hip whenever he would sprint. And so he'd try and sprint, and then, pain would come along, and he'd end up limping like a wounded gazelle. And this went on and off for a few days, and then I'm like, okay, fine, I gotta have a look at this. So I assessed his hip and everything in there and came to my thoughts that I think he's got a bit of a tear of the labrum of the hip, or an irritation of the labrum, irritation of the anterior aspect of his hip joint. Anyways, it was most painful, or rather, I could reproduce the pain when I took his hip into an external quadrant, so lying on his back, and take his hip up into flexion, and then abducted his hip all the way out. So that was painful, as was taking his hip all the way up into full flexion and adduction towards his shoulder. And both of those were painful. And I could get a bit of a click in that external quadrant if I also kind of lifted and did an anterior glide of his hip in through there. So I had done a little bit of that. He was lasering his hip as well. So at first, my treatment was all passive. We took him out of football because he, 14-year-old boys are not smart enough to know to monitor themselves and, don't sprint at this speed because it makes you sore, but you can still do, jogging and other training drills. It was just easier to take him out for a few days. So he had relative rest, he was lasering, and I was doing mobilizations. Then we got to a point where it's like, okay, yeah, it's not hurting him when he walks. I'm making him do exercises, walking up the stairs two at a time, three at a time, so that he is utilizing that one hip in a fully flexed position, weight-bearing, and having to work with that. So that was doing well. And then we got to a point where it's like, okay, we got to see you sprint. So we were doing some sprint retraining. So down in our basement on the treadmill, had him going along and warming up and then doing sprints at, I think we did 6 miles per hour, and that was okay. And then we'd walk, and then he would do a sprint at 7 miles per hour, and then he'd walk 8 miles per hour. We're doing a minute of the sprints and about a minute or 2 minutes of the walking. And then we get about to the 8 miles per hour, and his gait totally changed. It got worse. Now, I always joke, we always tell him, it's like, Cole, you run like a frickin' Neanderthal. Like, his arms are out to the side and his legs are going to the side. So he's looking like he's lunging, really, and lunging from side to side. And I can just picture him, like, with a club in his hand, chasing down a, baby dinosaur. So it's like, Cole, you run like a Neanderthal. You've got to run like a gazelle. You gotta run a little more like you're properly running. So, you know what? This was actually excellent because now he's running on the treadmill. He starts running like a Neanderthal at 8 miles per hour, and it was even worse at 9 miles per hour. And I'm like, you know what, Cole? I said, I think if you could improve your running pattern, you wouldn't strain the anterior aspect of your hip. So I said, okay. I said, and I've got a mirror that I've got propped up a little bit in front of the treadmill so that, because I wanted to watch my form when I was running as well. So it's there. I said, now look in the mirror when you're running, and I want you to try and be conscious of making sure that your feet are facing straight ahead. So when they land, heel toe and your Feet are pointing straight ahead. I want you to keep your arms in at your side so that your elbows aren't flying away from your side and you don't look like you're trying to punch the air. So that you're cutting through as smooth as possible. So as soon as we started working on his form, his hip hurt less. So we did that for a few nights, and I think he went back into football about a week later and everything was fine. But it was one of those where it's like, okay, this is interesting. So if we want him to return to sport, you know, part of that is me understanding the sport and where he was sore. So he was having pain, and he's a defensive back, so he runs after kids and tackles them. So whenever he was sprinting, now that's kind of important as a defensive back that you've got to be able to sprint, okay? It was important that I watch him and when it was giving him pain, so getting him on the treadmill, that was important. And it's important then that we had a plan for return to sport. So we needed to retrain. We needed to do, in his case, we needed to do gait retraining in order to properly heal everything that was going on. So it couldn't just be passive, okay? It couldn't just be me mobilizing him and doing the laser. There needed to be more. And this is the whole point in this audio, is I want you to think about the more, as in, what is the goal for this dog? Is it truly just to, you know, is it a New York dog that goes in and out of an apartment and just walks and, you know, and it's a potato and it doesn't have to do much more? Or does it go on jogs? Does it play agility? Is it an athlete? Is it weekend warrior? Or, you know, do they play ball with him in the park? Because really, you have to think about what are the movements that are involved with that activity and how do I retrain that? So let's take this now to the dogs, okay? So there were a couple of papers published last year, so 2013 in JAVMA by Kim Cullen et al. And I'm just going to sum up those two papers in a little bit as they would pertain. So it looked at agility dogs. They did a survey. So this was all done by survey, looking at injuries and where injuries occurred and all the rest. So compiling the data, and they had like 2,000 some odd dogs handled by 1,000 some odd handlers. So it was actually good response rate. Anyways, when we look at agility, they found that 32% of agility dogs sustained injuries. Okay, now I am going to say I'm going to bet that injury would be higher if those dogs were all coming for routine checkups, that you would find more subtle things, ribs, early signs of tendinosis lesions, sacroiliac joints, spinal issues, early signs of osteoarthritis. I think you would find more if they were coming routinely for checkups. We certainly do. But anyway, so this found that in what was reported, 32% had injuries that were attributable to agility. Border collies had the highest incidence, and it was 1.7 times higher odds of having an injury if your dog was a border collie. There were more injuries if the dogs were less than 4 years in experience. Okay, so this is also telling us then that training for sport is important. It may also be telling us about conditioning. But anyways, we have to extrapolate from some of this data. Now, 42% of the injuries were attributable to interaction with three pieces of equipment, and those being the A-frame, the dog walk, and bar jumps. So the A-frame, you know, they go up, they come down. The dog walk, they go up, they walk a platform, they come down. And the bar jumps, they're just jumping over jumps. Now, there's all sorts of jumps. There's plenty of jumps in agility. There's one A-frame and one dog walk. So it's quite interesting then that those are the pieces of equipment that were tended to be most problematic, or rather, that's what people reported. So my thought process there, and then they had some other correlations that looked at things like dogs that had injuries were ones that were also seeing alternative therapies, so be it acupuncture, chiropractic, massage. They didn't include physio and or PT, which kind of irks me because I'm pretty sure that in that some of them were seeing people like me. Anyways, which is interesting, and they commented as well that, well, you know, if they're seeing somebody, then the dog likely already has an injury. And if the dog already has an injury, well, then it's going to be predisposed to re-injuring and have a higher rate of re-injury. Okay? So, this leads me to my next component, which is to look at the research as it pertains to return to sport, and in particular, return to sport after an end. So what I picked is a muscle strain, so after hamstring strains, because there's a good deal of research out there. So, pardon me, you get to hear me flipping papers because I've got it all here and I want to put it in order for you. So, if we look at what's out there in the literature in regards to return to play, return to sport following muscle strain. So, I decided to choose for you Orchard et al., 2005, in Clinical Journal of Sports Medicine. And this was a literature review. Okay, and what they looked and they said that there are no consensus guidelines or agreed upon criteria for safe return to sport following muscle strains that completely eliminate the risk for recurrence and maximize performance. At this time, it may be a sensible strategy to allow earlier return to play in team sports and just accept a low to moderate injury recurrence rate. Just a little bit sad. Anyways, improved prognostic assessment of muscle strains with injury identification, so being MRI, and injury assessment, isokinetic testing, may assist practitioners to lower but not eliminate recurrent injuries. So, from that, I wanted to look and see, okay, so here we're saying that there isn't any real good criteria that says this is what's going to reduce re-injury and return to sport. So that was 2005. Now, number two. So then what I looked at is I found a nice paper, Fife et al., in the Journal of Electromyography and Kinesiology, 2013. And that paper was called The Role of Neuromuscular Inhibition in Hamstring Strain Injury Recurrence. And with this one, they said hamstring strain injuries are amongst the most common and problematic injuries in a wide range of sports that involve high-speed running. The comparatively high rate of hamstring injury recurrence is arguably the most concerning aspect of these injuries. Potentially, the persistence of risk factors and the development of maladaptations following injury may explain injury recurrence. And so, basically, this paper was looking at neuromuscular inhibition following injury and the potential mechanisms of the maladaptations. And the maladaptations included eccentric hamstring weakness, selective hamstring atrophy, and shifts in the knee flexor torque joint angle relationship. So basically meaning how much power your hamstrings had depending on how much or what range or your stifle, sorry, knee, what range your knee was in. So does it have the same power when your knee is flexed to 90 as compared to when it's almost straight or in more flexion? And they basically found there that current evidence indicates that athletes return to competition after hamstring injury having developed maladaptations that predispose them to further injury. So if you have a patient, in our case, a dog, that has had a muscle injury, a tendon injury, and I'm going to say joint injury or surgery to a joint, okay, they have likely developed adaptations and not appropriate adaptations, maladaptations. So, finish off this abstract. When rehabilitating athletes to return to competition following hamstring strain injuries, the role of neuromuscular inhibition in re-injury should be considered. So we need to look at the muscle patterns, the muscle firing, the reaction times, when muscles fire, when they shouldn't, balance, coordination, all of that will tie into that. That is going to be most helpful in preventing re-injury. And I'm going to say then in dogs that have, let's say, a unilateral cruciate injury, I think we would have a better chance of reducing the rate of cruciate tears on the contralateral leg if we are addressing dogs fully, taking them through this whole neuromuscular rehab. Addressing neuromuscular inhibition is as part of our rehab program. Okay, so hang on. That was number two. So number three paper. Okay, number three paper. So then I wanted to look at what was found about use of MRI and then isokinetic testing, because that 2005 paper had said, okay, well, maybe that's what we need to do, is look at utilize those kind of quantifiable measures to look at return to sport. So I found Rurink. R-E-U-R-I-C-K-I-N-K, Rurink. Okay, Rurink et al. In the British Journal of Sports Medicine, 2013. And they looked at utilizing the MRI and observing MRI findings at return to play in clinically recovered hamstring injuries. And they noted that in previous studies that it was shown that MRI of fresh hamstring injuries have a good diagnostic and prognostic value. So that if you have this kind of a tear, MRI shows that, well, it's okay, you're going to take longer to return to sport as compared to this other kind of injury. So they wanted to look at the clinical relevance of MRI at return to play. So now these athletes have all clinically recovered from their hamstring injuries. They have all gone back to compete as either amateur, elite, or professional athletes, and they were cleared for return to play. So they looked at, I think they did 53. They looked at the MRI of 53 consecutive athletes with hamstring injuries within 5 days of injury, and then within 3 days of return to play. So they knew the before, and now they're looking at them as the after they've been cleared to go back. Okay, and then they looked at re-injury rates within 2 months of their return to play. And what they found is that 89% of the clinically recovered hamstring injuries, so all the people that went back, they were clinically normal, showed intramuscular increased signal intensity on fluid-sensitive sequences on MRI, and so basically showing that they were not normal. And so they basically said that normalization of this increased signal intensity seems not required for successful return to play. And essentially saying that... That what they were looking at, that when they looked at the signals, that the MRI was not clinically relevant, okay, and did not seem to have an association with the injury or re-injuries rates, okay. So it didn't seem to have a correlation with that. So we don't need to MRI our patients either to see what things look like. Maybe we don't need to, whatever, diagnostic ultrasound either. We look at the clinical factors and look at return to play. Now, we will get into what we can be doing, should be doing, but so that's where MRI stands. Now, let's look at isokinetic testing. Okay, and this is the part that started it all off for me. So a study by Toll et al. In the British Journal of Sports Medicine, just published this year, 2014, And they looked at return to play following hamstring injury in professional football players. And they looked at their isokinetic deficits. So they had 52 professional football players. They all underwent isokinetic strength testing following a standardized rehabilitation program. And they decided that a contralateral deficit of more than 10% was considered abnormal. So let me back up and explain what is isokinetic. So I found a good definition. Isokinetic. An isokinetic muscle contraction is one in which the muscle contracts and shortens at a constant rate of speed. So this type of muscle contraction usually requires your special expensive training equipment that increases the load as it senses that the muscle contraction is speeding up. Okay? So this was, and I'll date myself as being old because we had a Kincom and a Cybex machine. Those were the two cool machines back in early 90s and late 80s that all the high-end sports training places had. And they could look at the isokinetic strength of hamstrings and quadriceps after people had undergone cruciate repairs. So anyways, it's this contraption you can sit in and it'll do exactly as that definition is. So the thought was that you have better muscle gains when you utilize this kind of thing and that it was a better way to test muscles. Okay, now what did they find when they looked at these football players that had returned to sport? They found that there was no significant difference in mean isokinetic peak torques and 10% isokinetic deficits in players without re-injury compared with re-injury players at 2 months post initial rehabilitation. Okay, so there wasn't a difference. And these results suggest that normalization of isokinetic strength is not an essential criteria for return to sport following an acute hamstring strain in your high-level athletes. Their conclusion was, okay, we do not understand the association between isokinetic strength deficits and re-injury rates. Okay, so we do not need to figure out how to get a dog onto the Kincom or Cybex machine because fortunately, not only would it have been difficult and expensive, fortunately, we are finding it is not going to help us learn about return to sport in dogs. Okay, so now let me get to my happy paper. Okay, so my paper number 6. So then this is the one that I thought summed it up quite nicely. And this paper was done by Sherry and Best, 2000, and this is a 2004, so this is interesting because this is going back in time. So all these other ones were saying, okay, well, maybe we need to do an MRI, maybe do we need to do isokinetic testing, or maybe we just need to go back into research. So back to 2004 in the Journal of Orthopedic Sports Physical Therapy. And what they did is they did a comparison of two rehabilitation programs. So this is why you're caring about this. So they looked at 24 athletes with acute hamstring strains, and they randomly assigned to one of two different rehab groups. So group one, they did static stretching, isolated progressive hamstring resistance training, and icing. And group two had progressive agility training and trunk stabilization exercises and icing. And, dun dun dun, what they found was that the average time to return to sport was not significantly different, you know, when they looked at it. So the group that did the stretching, stretching and isolated hamstring exercises, they returned to sport at 37 days, give or take 27 days. And the group that did the progressive agility training and trunk retraining returned to sport at 22 days, give or take 8.3. But that wasn't statistically significant. Now, in the first 2 weeks after return to sport, the re-injury rate was significantly greater in the stretching group. Okay, so 54.5%. So more than half of those injuries at the 2-week mark in return to sport, okay, suffered a recurrent hamstring strain, okay, after they had completed that program. As compared to none, zero, nada, zip, okay, none of them in the progressive agility training and trunk retraining group. That has got to tell us something, okay? Now, they took it further, and after 1 year of return to sports, the re-injury rate was still significantly greater in the stretching group, okay? And so in that group, 70% had re-injured, okay? As compared to only 7%, okay, of the ones who did the agility and trunk stabilization, okay, which is phenomenal. So we've got to think about, in through that, what this tells us is that your rehabilitation programs, if you've got a dog that's going back to sport, if you've got a dog that's going back to chasing a ball in the park, maybe, you've got to look at adding that neuromuscular rehabilitation, okay? So, that was it for those ones. So, essentially with that, my whole point in talking about this is to reiterate that not only now you've got research stuff that backs it up, okay, my point is, one, know the sport, okay? Know what this animal does, what is the sport, what activity do they do, even if it's running around in the backyard with a housemate. You gotta know that. Watch the athlete, okay? Watch the dog doing stuff and plan for return to sport by incorporating sport-specific retraining and neuromuscular retraining. Good. And I hope that helped you. And until next time, cheers.